Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the new courthouse. I'm not sure if we've had criminal argue yet in this new courthouse for the Court of Appeals. So, welcome. We're glad to have you. Our first case on calendar is Bowser versus State. It's case number 71516. And I'd ask both of you to please state your names for my clerks for the record and your co-counsel as well, so we have that from my clerk, who happens to be from Carson and doesn't know everybody. And would you like any rebuttal time?
I don't think so.
Oh, wait, you guys are switched. You're in the, usually that's the appellants. Whoops, I'm going to go back. Sorry. Would you like rebuttal time?
Yes, 2 minutes, please.
Okay. I guess we switch it around for criminal. That's how long it's been since we've seen a criminal case here. Usually the appellant has been sitting over there, but that's fine, no problem. No. It just got me off for a second. So whenever you're ready, you would like some time, and how much time would you like?
2 minutes, please.
2 minutes? Sure. All right, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Jamie Rush. I'm here on behalf of the appellant. Already reserved the 2 minutes for rebuttal. We have numerous issues here today to review. I think there may be as many as 7 of them. I'm going to try to hit on all of them the best I can, but I'd like to start with the supplemental issue because I think at the very least it represents the minimum amount of relief this court should grant Mr. Bowser. The issue in the supplemental briefing was simply this. There were two trials in this matter. At the first trial, counts 4 and 6 were smaller, minimum sentences perhaps even, and they were concurrent to count 2, which was the charge related to the killing itself, murder at that time. After the retrial, count 2 became voluntary manslaughter, and counts 4 and 6 became both longer and consecutive to count 2. We have alleged two problems with the trial court's decision to increase the sentences on counts 4 and count 6.
And where were that, counsel? And that was exactly the question I was going to pose to you on this issue. The issue here is that you have Judge Gates, who presides over the first trial. 10 years pass, and Judge Kadish presides over the second jury trial. Certainly, a different judge has the discretion to sentence as she hears the evidence in the case. Why should she be bound by what the first trial judge did? And also, isn't that reason alone to show, affirmatively show on the record, that there was no vindictiveness? You know, it's one thing when one trial judge hears a case, the appellate court reverses, and then the same judge, quote, vindictively decides, well, I got reversed, I think I'll sentence this defendant and punish him. We don't really have that here. Isn't just the fact that it's two different judges affirmatively showing on the record that there's no vindictiveness?
I appreciate that question, and no, I don't believe that that's the case. And blessedly, we have some framework from the Nevada Supreme Court with which to view the situation. The first is the Dolby and Wilson series of cases, and I would suggest that those outright forbid increasing a sentence after it's been previously vacated. I'm not aware of any Nevada Supreme Court case that says you can't do that. Certainly, the state did not mention any. Dolby itself extensively discusses the so-called heightened double jeopardy protections that Nevada provides to its citizens. It would be a reasonable and natural extension of those cases to say, well, although they specifically dealt with sentences that were vacated and not actually retried, we are in fact talking about the exact same charges and the exact same outcomes as it relates to counts 4 and 6.
But technically speaking, the second sentence isn't even longer. The first one is a 40 to life, and the second one is actually technically shorter than that.
I appreciate that as well, and I would just suggest that in Dolby and Wilson, the Nevada Supreme Court decided not to adopt that type of approach, looking at the so-called greater scheme of the overall sentence. Instead, they took it sentence by sentence and asked, well, as to each count, what was it increased? So that was the outcome in Dolby and Wilson, and I believe that that could be readily extended here.
Well, but the problem here is the counts aren't the same. He was convicted of different crimes the first time around, so you're comparing apples and oranges. It would be, I think the Dolby case is talking about if you're convicted of the exact same things in both trials, and in the exact same counts, the sentences are different, but in this case, he's actually convicted of different things in the second trial, so isn't it apples and oranges?
I don't believe that it is. The practical reality is, of course, his current sentence is shorter, but that is largely due to the fact that he's no longer convicted of murder and no longer serving a life sentence. Counts 4 and 6 are the exact same charges that they were at the first trial. It's just that those charges have now been increased. And I would suggest that the reason that they were increased was at the state's request to try and best approach the original sentence, which was, as the state requested, as long as possible. At the first trial, that's easy to do when it's a life sentence. At the second trial, you have a little bit of work to do, and the only way that the court could approach the first sentence in any manner was to start running the counts consecutive instead of concurrent. Even if these concerns about the fact that there was a retrial and not just these sentences being vacated were to give the court any trouble, I would simply suggest that the Nevada Supreme Court has also addressed that situation in the Holbrook decision. Now, the state did not respond to that part of our supplemental briefing at all. Maybe we'll hear about it in the next 10 minutes and 50 seconds for the first time. But the Nevada Supreme Court has already said, if it is permissible to increase a sentence after retrial, the reasons for doing so both, number one, have to affirmatively appear in the record, and number two, be based on conduct by the defendant. We don't have either of those things in this particular case. I understand the court's concern about a change in judges, but there isn't any change in the defendant's behavior that would justify an increased sentence. In fact, the court went out of its way to note that it so-called been a model prisoner, and nothing had really changed between the time of the first trial and the second trial, other than the verdict itself. So, the outcome, the most reasonable outcome for looking at the increased sentences here is that, at a minimum, they are indefensible under Holbrook, and that the original sentences should be, the current sentences should be reverted to the original sentences as it pertains to counts 4 and 6 to best approach the limits that were originally posed by the judge who originally heard the trial. Of course, none of that may be necessary if we grant a new trial based on any of the other six claims before this court, so I'll turn to those as well. The first of which, of course, is the Batson issue, and this has been the source of great litigation over the years in Nevada and other states as well. Let me start by saying this. The state's brief addresses a couple of our concerns, and I'll try to comment on those here. One of which was that I believe the state is contending we can't have a Batson claim at all because there was no identifiable group of jurors, the so-called step one of the Batson analysis. But here, the trial court found that step one was satisfied, and whether it's an express requirement or just something the court implied, it's obvious based on the record that the trial judge asked the state to provide its reasons for striking the three jurors at issue, and the state provided those reasons. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that it is a low standard at the step one part of the Batson analysis, a suspicion, if you will, of discriminatory intent. Here, I think we can easily say the trial judge suspected that these were minority class members at a minimum. But also the Nevada Supreme Court has held that once the state supplies its reasons for striking particular jurors, we move on from step one and we're only going to consider step two and step three. In this particular case, the state certainly supplied reasons for each of the three jurors, and so I'm left to say that the step three analysis was flawed by the trial court and that, in fact, it was purposeful discrimination that led to those jurors being eliminated. Another issue raised by the state was, in particular, to juror Silva, that because he was an alternate juror, that we should limit our analysis to the alternate juror in terms of comparing the responses. I don't believe that's the best way to proceed. I provided some cases in the reply brief that explain that. There's simply no way to know who's going to be an alternate and who's going to be needed at such an early stage of the trial.
Well, sometimes that's not true because generally I used to tell them right up front who was the alternate. Everybody does jury selection different. I use the Arizona method. So the last two jurors in the last two seats, everybody knew up front that they were going to be alternate. At least the attorneys did, and of course we told the jurors when they were seated as well.
Sure.
And so you do know that.
Okay, well,
sometimes.
I'll grant the court this. It may be possible to know, okay, these are going to be our alternates. It is not possible to know if something's going to go wrong and we're going to actually need those alternates. So the question of whether or not...
It happened though, in this case, did it?
I don't believe that they did.
Never deliberated, right?
I don't think that they did. Nonetheless, with respect to Silva, I would still say that the error, if it is error under Batson, is there's plenty of language in the U.S. Supreme Court cases that discuss this. It's a harm against society, not just something related to Mr. Bowser. So when a minority juror is improperly excluded, it harms all society. And so, to the extent that we would ask, well, was it harmless? He was an alternate. He wasn't going to deliberate anyway. I don't think that would be the correct framework with which to view it. Instead, if we view Mr. Silva's responses in light of the other responses given, the issue for why the state got rid of him was largely that he was unemployed and his answers were flat compared to the other jurors. I've tried to explain in the briefing that there was at least one other alternate juror, Ms. Enos, that gave flat responses, and the issue of unemployment did not even appear in the state's briefing on this appeal. So I would simply suggest that the fact that that apparently has been abandoned because it wasn't true, there were other jurors who were unemployed, is evidence in and of itself that the other reasons given for excluding that juror may also have been covered for discriminatory intent. There aren't that many United States Supreme Court cases interpreting Batson. It's, approximately...
It's really that third step that we would be concerned about anyway in the district court's record on this.
Oh, of course.
Here, the district court did make an adequate record, did it not? When it did deny the challenges.
It made a record of its findings, but my argument is that those findings were in error based on, it should have been this consideration, and I don't think that this is really borne out by the trial court, of a comparative analysis of the responses of the other jurors. In Miller-El, the U.S. Supreme Court is one of the rare cases where they've actually granted relief on a Batson claim, and the things that they focused on in that case and in a couple subsequent cases were, what kind of questions did the state ask prior to striking the juror, and how did the jurors' responses compare with jurors who were seated? When we ask both of those questions in this case, we see that the state didn't even question two of the three jurors, Mr. Kano and Mr. Silver, were not questioned by the state at all. And then in terms of a comparative analysis, again, one of the other jurors gave flat answers with respect to juror Kano. There was a second juror, it was Mattis, I believe, who stated she found the process nerve-wracking, whereas Mr. Kano was so-called overwhelmed by the process, and that was the reason for the state strike. And then with respect to Mr. Dalton, the concern was that he had stated that he was concerned that a defendant may not testify because they would have their words twisted by the state. But at least one other juror, also was Ms. Mattis, I believe, actually used the word twist in her response when she was asked about how she viewed the ability of the defendant to testify and what would happen on cross-examination. So if, in fact, so-called twisting of words was a legitimate concern to the state, then they surely would have wanted to get rid of Ms. Mattis, who used that exact same language about twisting words, and instead she was retained and Mr. Dalton, it was excluded. So I would suggest that for all those reasons, the reasons the state gave for getting rid of these three jurors were, in fact, discriminatory and not legitimate as stated by the state. We are quickly running out of time, so let me talk briefly about a related issue with juror Sonnerholm, who was kept in lieu of one of the excluded jurors. There was evidence in the record that he fell asleep. I would simply suggest that the exploration of that issue by the trial court was not as robust as it could have been. There were court staff that supposedly observed him, in fact, actually sleeping, and they were not consulted on the record, at least, as to those views. I believe if they had been, there would have been greater weight to be able to say, okay, in fact, the juror was sleeping, why don't we replace him with one of the alternates? There are also a couple of brief evidentiary issues. The question of the toxicology report. The issue here is that the jury heard about it but didn't get to see it. And the main concern that I would have in behalf of Mr. Bowser is that on redirect, and this was page 968 in the record, the state was able to explore with the detective who talked about that report whether or not it was reliable, and information came out that, well, maybe it was a false positive. The question here is,
why get the report in? I mean, at that point, isn't it harmless error? I mean, the report didn't come in. But Mr. Reed was easily, I mean, almost brilliant, I think, got in through the back door. He asked the detective, you know, about the, isn't it true you knew that he had meth in the system? Isn't it true you knew that the victim had guns in the car? And in fact, you have a voluntary manslaughter from a first-degree murder. I mean, the verdict itself almost reflects that evidence got in with or without the toxicology report. So why wouldn't it be harmless at that point?
Well, thank you. It's certainly hard to say that there wasn't an improvement for the first trial. Of course there was. But maybe there would have been further improvement. I would simply suggest that juries like documents. There's really no other way to look at it other than if they had been able to see the report, they could have made their own conclusion, whether it shows a false positive or what it says.
But the detective who worked the case, presumably the homicide detective, acknowledged to the jury, yes, in fact, the victim had meth in the system.
He did, and I would simply again suggest that that's no substitute for the actual document itself. It was such a material issue to the case, at least for the defense, trying to portray the things that were happening in this somewhat racially charged case. It was part of three or four things that had to do with victim characteristics that probably did lead to the improved verdict, and there may have been a further improvement had that important information been presented in documentary form. There's also the question about hearsay.
Do you want to keep going, or I'll give you 2 minutes. You're at 1 minute and 30 seconds.
All right, I would appreciate that.
Okay.
Let me turn to the jury instruction and jury
instruction. You want to keep going then and not take rebuttal? Because you're at, I will give you 2 minutes because I asked you a question there at the end.
Okay. All right. Let's use 1 minute and then I'll take your 1 minute for rebuttal.
Okay.
Very briefly, the jury instruction and then. I would suggest here that the jury was not only misinstructed about mere presence, but actually asked a question about that, which was then misanswered. Really quickly, the state first contends the instruction was not wrong because we haven't provided any authority for that fact. I would suggest that is not the case at all. We've cited Brooks versus State in our opening brief. It very clearly says, here's the instruction used for mere presence. It includes the first sentence of the instruction was given, not the second sentence, which is at issue here. I believe the second sentence may have confused the jury as evidenced by the fact that they then asked the question, hey, can you be guilty for shooting out of a vehicle by association? Here, Mr. Bowser was not consulted about responding to that note. Mr. Reed was not present for the response to that note. And we do have evidence, which is consistent with the Manning case that the Mass Supreme Court says. The question is, well, how would it be any different if counsel or client had been there? Well, we see that Mr. Reed had a very different answer to that question than was given by a trial counsel. If that answer had been given, which was a no, versus just go back and look at the instructions, I do believe that there would have been a different outcome. All right, with that, I'll reserve my remaining time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Michelle Fleck, and I'm here representing the respondent of the state of Nevada. This morning, I'd like to start where the appellant started, which is with double jeopardy. And I would echo what the court actually said. In this particular case, not only did the judge change, the evidence changed. In fact, the entire defense changed. In the first trial, the defense came in and they conceded guilt. They just asked for a lesser. In the second trial, they basically changed the entire course of their defense, and their new defense was it was a coerced confession, there was police bias, and the defendant was slow. There were vastly different evidentiary rulings in this case. So not only was it a different judge, but she heard an entirely different trial. The cases that are cited by the appellant Wilson, Dolby, and Holbrook all stand for a resentencing of the same case in front of the same judge. And as this court already pointed out, the concern being the vindictiveness. The fact that Judge Kadish didn't even max the defendant out on this case shows that she wasn't vindictive in any way, that she was just considering the new case that she saw before her and was resentencing after a reversal and based it then on a new trial. Addressing Batson.
And before you address Batson, are you familiar with the Nevada Supreme Court case of Jones versus State, Edward Lee Jones?
I'm not, Your Honor.
Well, in that case, 20 years ago, it's an opinion. The Nevada Supreme Court on a death penalty murder case held that a prosecutor calling a defendant in a murder case, calling that defendant an animal, was prosecutorial misconduct. So knowing that there's an opinion on point stating that this is, in fact, prosecutorial misconduct. Can you explain to this court, like I had to explain to the Supreme Court 20 years ago, how the error would be harmless in this case?
I will, Your Honor. First of all, I would like to point out that when that comment was made, the counsel did immediately, an objection was made, counsel immediately apologized and moved on. I think that, as you know from reading the record, this became a fairly contentious trial, and passions were definitely inflamed. So I think that it was said in the heat of passion, and it was immediately apologized for. It was harmless because of the overwhelming evidence in this case showing guilt. The defendant is caught within minutes after the shooting in a car with the co-defendant with a loaded shotgun right next to the car. There's a box of shells, shotgun ammunition with the defendant's prints all over it. There's a full confession that's given within the same evening. There's so much overwhelming evidence that I do believe that that would be harmless error. And again, it was addressed and apologized for immediately.
What about the other comment disparaging defense counsel?
Was that with regard to the hunt or which?
Not the hunt. I'd have to look back exactly what was said. Hold on. It was something about this. I want to say the story. You know, I'd have to go back and check.
Okay.
I don't want to take up your time, but it's disparaging counsel as far as believing his version of events. The only one that could believe it would be the defense. Something to that effect.
Okay. So, you know, The only thing that I can address without knowing exactly what it was is that in the heat of the trial, as you all know, there are some times that you have a slip of the tongue and you say something in the heat of your argument that is not necessarily meant to be disparaging in any way. I know that neither me nor Mr. Volani were in any way intending to ever disparage the defense attorneys. Again, I believe it would be harmless based upon the overwhelming evidence against Mr. Dowson. The ultimate verdict in this case does not reflect, of course, what we thought that the evidence showed. As the appellant pointed out, this did become a convoluted case. There were race issues, and that ultimately even went into the jury deliberation room. There were evidentiary rulings in the case that centered on race. It was a very racially charged time period in 2015 with what was going on just around the country.
So why object to the toxicology report? What's the point of that? It was endorsed by you in 2005. You endorsed the custodian of records of the toxicology. You know, if that victim did not have methamphetamine in his system, you know darn well you both would have asked the coroner on record or made sure that that came in, that the victim didn't have drugs. Why would you argue with the district court judge? Why do you care in this case where you say it's so overwhelming when they want to present their case in chief and they're going to call their witnesses and it's their case and they move to call the toxicology report on a meth in the body?
Okay.
Why can't you just put in the prior testimony from the prior trial of the coroner that says it's a false positive? Why do you dig your heels in and not allow the defense to put in their case in chief? I'm baffled by this.
Well, so to understand what was going on with the meth, you have to kind of look through the entire trial in terms of the back and forth and the flip-flopping of the court's rulings in terms of the meth coming in. The defense repeatedly said throughout this trial that the only reason that they wanted to even mention that methamphetamine was in the victim's system, or possibly in his system, was to attack the detectives and what they knew and what they did with that information. They assured the court over and over that it was never going to be used substantively.
So why not argue it? Why not let it come in? And why don't you argue that to the jury?
Well,
why not do that and say, so what? They didn't even know what that toxicology report had to be a month or so later. Why not let them? I mean, they're going to do it anyway, and they're going to cross. Why not allow them to put their case on?
Well, in our opinion, they did put their case on. They were able to get in what we deemed to be inadmissible, bad character evidence that was only offered in a way to cast a shadow on our victim. I mean, based upon his family, which is why the toxicology report was questioned in the first place in trial one, which is how they came up with the idea and the notion that this was a false positive, and why Dr. Tegenhoff testified to the fact that because of the methamphetamine versus amphetamine, it's likely a false positive. The family was adamant that this man never, ever, ever, ever did drugs, and that's why it came up. So our opinion was,
you put the coroner's report right in. This is, I think it's a false positive.
Well, we didn't have, I mean, it doesn't say that in the coroner's report. So what we would have had to do.
The coroner's prior testimony did. Dr. Tellenhoff did testify to that. You, in rebuttal, could have easily marked that as an exhibit, said, well, or put somebody up on the stand, have them read that right after they put their custodian of records, who's flat, on the stand. You just didn't say that. But by doing that, why create error in the record for not letting them put in their case?
Well, you're right in hindsight that, you know, we could have sort of thrown this back at them and used that evidence in rebuttal as something powerful to sort of belie what they were saying.
Isn't the district court's job a gatekeeper of evidence? And the relevance is still there for the defense. They ended up getting a voluntary manslaughter, so clearly this type of evidence becomes relevant, and it is their defense theory.
But the evidence,
and yet you said no. Objected to it over and over, and finally the district court judge gives in.
Well, she gave in to the fact that the document couldn't come in, and that was because there was issues as to its trustworthiness and veracity, which...
No, that's not to its admission, to the weight to be given, which is the jury's function.
The jury did get that information, though. I mean, they got it in opening, they got it through cross-examination, they got it in the closing arguments, so they were repeatedly told that the defendant likely had or may have had methamphetamine in his system, and it was then even argued in the closing as, you know, maybe this was a road rage, so what were the effects of that methamphetamine? So to suggest that there was any prejudice to the defense in this case based upon that, I mean, that was a huge piece of evidence for them to go forward and kind of create their defense and defend the client in terms of possible road rage or possible self-defense. They were given voluntary manslaughter instructions. They were even though the defendant was the non-shooter, they were given voluntary manslaughter instructions. So they were given voluntary manslaughter. We did not believe there was any evidence of that. They were given self-defense. We did not believe there was any evidence of that. And ultimately, they got a very favorable verdict. So, it was the state's position that all of that did come in, whether it was through the document or through the, way of cross-examination and argument by counsel. They were not prohibited in any way from that evidence. So, briefly then, going to Batson, I think that this is a case that illustrates kind of how far afield and how exploited something that is as important as Batson can be. You have three jurors in this case, Mr. Cano, Mr. Silva, and Mr. Dalton. The appellant has said that the court made a prima facie showing. Absolutely, she did not. And in fact, she specifically said in volume three at page 547, she could not tell that Mr. Cano was Asian, and she had that noted. She could not tell that Mr. Silva was Hispanic, and she had that noted. So the only person in this group that is a cognizable group is Mr. Dalton. And he had a textbook, race-neutral reason. Specifically, he said, his exact words were, if the defendant were to get up here and testify, I don't feel like the prosecution would come out here and try to figure out the truth. They would try to turn his words into admitting to the crime. So clearly that was a race-neutral reason. But, the judge, she posed it as a hypothetical, that she didn't see that these people were even of a recognized cognizant group. Even that being said, let's go ahead and err on the side of caution and have you make those race-neutral reasons. So, I feel as though such an important premise of protecting the integrity of the jury process of who can sit and that the defendant gets a fair trial is really exploited in this case by the jurors that they have picked and by the argument that has been made. As to the other issues regarding that the appellant has brought up, the mere presence instruction, that was a direct quote from Robertson v. Sheriff. Additionally, Mr. Reed conceded in the record at volume 5, page 1011, that this was a correct statement of the law. Certainly there is nothing to suggest that both Mr. Reed and Ms. Hojat needed to be there for the jury question. Appellant cites Manning v. State. That's very different because the court was faced with a possible deadlock jury and never even contacted the parties. So I think that there's quite a difference in that. So unless there are further questions from any of the judges, I will submit the case to your discretion. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Here's a couple of quick responses to what we just heard. With regard to the supplemental issue, Holbrook is based on Pierce, which itself is a United States Supreme Court case. Neither case talks about whether or not there was a change in the judge. The question of whether or not the sentence can be increased after a retrial, which was the issue in both of those cases, is the conduct of the defendant, not a change in the judiciary or anything else. So where there was no change in the defendant's conduct that was identified on the record, such as in this case, then the sentence cannot be increased as to counts 4 and count 6. That's under Pierce, the United States Supreme Court case, and Holbrook, the Nevada Supreme Court case that discusses it. With regard to the issue of prosecutorial misconduct, we just heard that it was an inflammatory case, obviously a racially charged case. That being the case, I would simply suggest don't throw a gas can on the case by calling the defendant an animal and saying that he's out hunting. In fact, it was the co-defendant that did the actual shooting of the offense. I'm not trying to diminish Mr. Bowser's role in that, but the jury didn't find him guilty of the conspiracy to commit those events. They simply found him guilty of voluntary manslaughter with use of deadly weapon. So in a case that, again, involved these different tones, the exclusion of jurors, the factual evidence that came out regarding the victim, and then, of course, Mr. Bowser was African-American, all of these things play into the fact that, yeah, calling him an animal is improper and an improper statement of the prosecutor's personal opinion. Same issue with hunting. Both of those inflame a case that was already on, on the cusp of being an informed jury as explained by the state. You know what, I believe that's it. Unless there are any further questions, I do appreciate the court's time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Both sides, what a pleasure it's been. It's really well briefed, and you argued it. Both sides, really, really great. This was a pleasure. So thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Appreciate your arguments. We'll just be at ease for a moment while we go to our next case.